The heavens call to you and wheel about you, revealing their eternal splendors, Virgil told Dante in Purgatorio 14. But your eyes are fixed upon the earth. For that he, the seeing all, does smite you. This is the After Dinner Scholar podcast from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. While we could blame light pollution or television or lack of interest or any number of other modern maladies, it's clear that just as in Dante's time, the heavens wheel about us and even call to us to look, and most of us never notice. If, for example, you know the phase of the moon today, you're part of a tiny, tiny minority of modern people. Virgil accuses us as well. Your eyes are fixed upon the earth. Dante lived at the turn of the 14th century, and in his writings used a model of the universe conceived in the 2nd century by astronomer and mathematician Claudius Ptolemy. Born in AD 100 in Alexandria, Egypt, Ptolemy argued from observation of the heavens that the earth, a sphere, was at the center of the universe, and around it the moon, sun, planets, and stars rotated. Well, clearly we no longer believe that, but Ptolemy still has a great deal to teach us about observing the sky and marking its beauty and regularity. Dr. Henry Zepeda taught Ptolemy, Copernicus, and Galileo to our high school students who have been here at Wyoming Catholic College for our PEAK program. I began by asking Dr. Zepeda to give us a bit of background about Ptolemy and about his astronomical methods.
Ptolemy was living in the Greek world in the 2nd century AD. He worked on lots of different subjects, but the thing that runs through all of them, or almost all of them, is that he was applying mathematics to the natural world. So whether that was music or geography or the stars, he also did astrology as well, and that was not so mathematical. So he is most well known for his Almagest, which is his big astronomical work, not his only astronomical work, but his major one, in which he lays out a complete system for the universe. He talks at first in a little section about the fundamental principles of his universe, I guess you might call them, that it's that the universe is a sphere, that we are on a spherical earth centered right at the very exact center, and we don't move, and we watch other things move around us in circles according to orderly uniform motions. Even if the appearances aren't orderly, they can ultimately be resolved down to orderly circular motions.
And all done with mathematics.
Yeah. So you can predict, you can figure out how fast everything's moving, how far things are away, or at least relatively, in relation to other things, how far things are from us. And then you can predict where things will appear in the future.
Now let's look at the questions Ptolemy answered in the readings that you assigned to the PEAK students. First, he argued correctly that the universe is a sphere. Tell us about that. Is that correct?
Well, he makes some arguments here that actually hold water. He looks at the way that, at least to the appearances, things move around us, and at least on the experiential level. And he's able to argue that things appear to move as if they're rotating around an axis going through us and the North and South Poles. He's able to see that. And his arguments actually make sense for that. But he adds some arguments that seem very strange to us, at least at first. He argues that the universe is the most unhampered and freely moving thing out there. So, what is the shape that is most freely moving and unhampered? A sphere. So, obviously, the universe is a sphere. Or the sphere is the greatest shape, so if you're given a certain perimeter, the sphere is greater than any other shape you could make with that same perimeter. So it's the greatest of shapes. Well, the universe is the greatest of bodies, so it's going to be a sphere. He also makes an argument from the way that the that the universe is made up, or the heavens are made up of ether, some element that is fundamentally different than the stuff that things down here on Earth are made of. These arguments seemed a little more confusing to the students, and these are the ones that he actually uses to argue not just that things rotate around an axis, but that the actual shape of the universe is a sphere. And no, this isn't right. But we tried to see why someone would think this and see whether these are reasonable arguments, even if ultimately they are faulty.
And next he argued, long, long before 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, quote, that the Earth, too, as a whole, is sensibly spherical. How did he come to that conclusion?
Yeah, this is actually something that the students, I think, enjoyed because it made more sense to them. You can see that the Earth is round and convex from the fact that we need time zones. And this is easy to see now when I can call somebody up and say, the sun just rose here in Lander, you in New York, what's happening there? And they can say that it rose 3 hours ago. That can tell us that we need to have a curved Earth, at least in the east-west direction. This is a little harder to do before you have instantaneous communication. Yeah, but a lunar eclipse provides an occasion to compare local times. So when a lunar eclipse happens, the Earth and the Sun and the Moon are all lined up. So the Moon is falling into the shadow of the Earth. And this happens just at an instant of time. But when people observe this, it might be at different times according to their local times. One person might see this lunar eclipse occur, or let's say an hour after sunset. Somebody else sees it set 3 hours after sunset. Well, how do you explain that? The lunar eclipse happens at the same time, so their sunsets actually must occur at different times. Well, why would their sunsets occur at different times? We're on a curved Earth. So you're able to argue in that way that we have a curved Earth in the east-west direction, and that we also have the Earth curve in the north-south direction is clear from travels made north and south. You see the pole star rise and, or lower in the sky. So you're able to see that, see the rotundity of the Earth pretty simply.
And that conclusion was never seriously doubted for the next 14 plus centuries.
No.
I was just reading that it was in the late 1800s that the myth of flat earthers was created by those who wanted to be boosters for science.
Yeah, it seems to have some origins in the during the Enlightenment, I think as some sort of anti-Catholic or anti-Christian feelings. And I believe Washington Irving had a great role in spreading that myth and making it such a long-lived one.
Back to Ptolemy. Then he argued that the Earth is the middle of the heavens. And again, he argued that by observation. What did he have to say, and why did it make a certain amount of sense?
Yeah, so we have to go back a little bit to his arguments for why the universe is spherical. So he ends up saying that it has to be spherical because the greatest shape is spherical, and there's a certain correspondence between mathematics and in the physical world that the greatest geometrical shape is a sphere, the greatest physical shape should also be a sphere, and also that freely moving motion in the ether argument. He gets to the point where he's convinced, even if our students are not convinced, that the universe is a sphere. And then once you think that, and that we're on a little speck inside of that, there actually is nowhere to put us except right at the middle, at least very, very close to the center. One thing that makes us think this is that the horizon divides the sky into two parts, one above the horizon, one below the horizon, right? And the two parts always end up being equal. And this has consequences when it comes to things like when the equinox will occur, whether there will be an equinox, and when that will occur in relation to the solstices. And he's able to argue from what we do see and say that the only way we get this is if we're right in the middle. We do not necessarily divide up the heavens in the correct way unless we're at the center. Now this, again, this argument is assuming or supposing is the conclusion of his previous arguments that we probably do not find all that convincing. So these arguments are fine once we take his suppositions, but we probably aren't going to do that. So we probably will see some problems with these arguments about being in the center of the universe.
And if we're in the center of the universe, the fourth argument that he makes is that the Earth doesn't move.
Yes. So if we're at the middle, we must be at the middle. You can't move or else you wouldn't be at the middle anymore. So that's one of his main arguments for the fact that we must be immobile. He thinks that we can't even rotate at the center of the universe. And the reason he thinks that comes down to the physics of the matter. In antiquity, there wasn't a physics that could explain why we could be spinning around on the Earth at maybe 1,000 miles per hour and not even notice it. We could walk in the direction of rotation at the same speed as we could walk in the opposite direction. We can throw something up in the air and it'll come down in exactly the same spot. There is no apparent motion that we have. We do not feel that we are rotating. So, and there's no physics yet to explain why this would make sense. Our common everyday experience of things that are undergoing a tremendously fast motion are that it's very disruptive, things fall apart, heavier things move farther while the lighter things fall off. These are things we really experience when we experience violent, fast motions. And when he thinks about what we should see if we're going to spin, he goes back to this experience and comes to ultimately a wrong conclusion, because we need to, ultimately the physics can explain why we're rotating without noticing it.
Studying Ptolemy is kind of helpful if you're reading Dante. But he was wrong about a lot of things. Why keep studying him in the geocentric model of the universe today?
Oh, there are at least a couple of things that I wanted to get across while teaching Peake. One is that we have an excellent opportunity to compare two very different understandings of the universe, one with the Earth at the center, one with the Sun at the center. And we can think about why we prefer one over the other. At the time of Copernicus, and even at the time of Galileo, there's no definitive proof that one of these theories is better than the other one. And there's no bit of evidence that we see or experience we have that doesn't make any sense at all with one of them and makes perfect sense with the other. In fact, it ends up coming down more of a matter of preference for or a supposition that the best explanations for the natural world are ones that are simple and beautiful. And I think we see this when we look at these two theories where there is no, well, at least not until about the middle of the 1800s, there isn't real definitive experience that shows that we are in motion. So we see what it is that makes us choose one theory over another when there isn't that kind of certain proof. Yeah, another reason that I think it's interesting to study the Ptolemaic system and the Copernican system and the debate about which one was right is the theological issue. A big objection to the new Copernican theory is that it seems to contradict some passages in the Bible. So I had the students read a letter from Galileo and a letter from Robert Bellarmine expressing some principles for how to interpret the Bible when it seems to contradict what we learn from our natural reason. And ultimately, their principles are fairly similar, but they come down to some differences of how to apply them and whether how they should be applied to that particular case. But I think it's good for the students to think about this.
Good. And how did the students respond?
Oh, they really liked it. Yeah. They like it. We also went stargazing, which is another thing that was very nice. We're talking about these books, and then we're talking about these ideas, and then we go out and see what they're talking about. They're talking about the path of the sun. We've been reading about the path of the sun through the ecliptic, through the zodiac, and then we go out and we see the signs of the zodiac. We've been talking about how the planets move through there, and then we go and we see, we're looking at Jupiter and Saturn sitting right in that band, in that zodiac. So it's nice to connect this back to the real. I mean, this is one of the things we do here. We take our ideas, but we're not just exploring isolated ideas, but we're connecting them to the real things out there.
Some people, in order to discover God, read books, wrote St. Augustine. But there is a great book, The Very Appearance of Created Things. Look above you, look below you, read it. God, whom you want to discover, never wrote that book with ink. Instead, he set before your eyes the things that he had made. Can you ask for a louder voice than that? After reading Ptolemy's observations and interviewing Dr. Zepeda, I at least want to be a bit more attentive about the heavens above and the earth below as they declare the glory of God. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.